The following takes place between 7 and 8.
Welcome to All About Wine on Blog Talk Radio with your host, Ron of Florida Estates Winery. Wine enthusiasts can call us at any time during the broadcast by dialing 646-727-3235. Once again, the number is 646-727-3235. Wine industry representatives are also encouraged to join us on air.
This is Stuart Scott from Camas Prairie Winery in Moscow, Idaho.
Mike Brown, the Wine Growers Association of Georgia.
The executive director.
Michelle Meyer, I work with my father, Les Meyer, at Holyfield Vineyard and Winery in Basser, Kansas.
Westport Rivers Vineyard and Winery.
We're located at 417 Vicksburg Road, Westport, Mass., and our phone number is 508.
I'm on the board of directors for the Minnesota Grape Growers Association.
Always informative and entertaining.
Basically, what we're trying to do on this program is trying to educate people on, you know, trying to make wine less confusing and more friendly.
It's all about wine.
Thank you. Those people, thank you.
The one and only. That's right. I don't know if I'm talking both of them or not. Okay, settle down.
All right, those people. Settle down.
Wow, they are really rowdy.
A nice day, so.
Yes, it is. It's a very nice day outside. The skies are clear, and compared to yesterday, it's very, really, really nice. And I just wanted to mention real quick that the individuals that you heard talking during our little intro there, those were the actual guests that we have had. And, we could almost do a whole show just with little clips of, you know, our previous guests talking and everything, because we've had quite a few now. And it's really, really good. And we have a couple of them coming on tonight. And so that's going to be cool from our state of the evening.
Our state of the evening.
Yeah. Our state of the week address is New Hampshire. And we're going to actually have some individuals from New Hampshire talking to us live here in just a moment. So stick around for that. We'll start off here in a minute. And I guess I need to go get some people on the phone. So
let me tell a little bit about New Hampshire here, and let me talk a little bit about the state and tell people about it.
And I'll be right back.
All right, you know, let me know when you got them. New Hampshire is where we're heading tonight. That is in the northeastern United States. For all of you who aren't familiar with it, it is way on up in the corner, in the northeastern corner. The only state that's further east is Maine. New Hampshire borders Maine on the east, borders Vermont on the west, south of New Hampshire is Massachusetts, and a bit of it touches the Atlantic Ocean. And then up at the top edge of New Hampshire, we have Canada, our neighbors to the north. It is a cold state, you know, for all of you who are not familiar with that part of the country. Not a big area of cold. Bordered on the west by the Connecticut River, which is covers almost the entire border the western border of New Hampshire. Just a little bit to the north, running Connecticut River source is the second Connecticut Lake and the first Connecticut Lake. And then it runs all the way down the border. The elevation in New Hampshire, there are some mountains, if you will, part of the Appalachian chain. And it is on up in that part there, although they're very old mountain chains, so it's gotten down a little bit lower. The counties, I always like to bring up how many counties. New Hampshire has only 10 counties, and they are large counties. When I first looked up the counties, I was quite surprised to see that the counties are so large. Coos County, I believe it's pronounced COOS, is at the northern part of the state, with Rockingham on the southeast county, Merrimack, and out the center. And Merrimack I bring up because that is where the state capital is located, in Merrimack County. That's Concord, the state capital. And I bring up also Rockingham because that's where a lot of the wineries are located, down in the southeast part of the state. The major highways running through New Hampshire, we have I-93, Interstate 93, running out of Vermont all the way down going into Massachusetts. Over on the edge, southeast edge, is I-95, just a bit of it. And also going out of Concord and heading over toward Vermont, I-89. So those are the major interstates that run through there. Concord being the capital, which is located in the south central part of the state. Nashua, which is right just north of the Massachusetts border. Claremont, Keene, Laconia, these are all different different towns within the state. Elevation, it goes from sea level, Atlantic Ocean, the lowest point in the state at sea level, and up to, the highest point is located on Mount Washington, which is 6,288 feet above sea level. So quite a change of it. Most of the higher elevation is in the northern part of the state, northern and central part of the state. A few little bit of elevation running over to the western part of the state, but most of it up to the center. That probably explains why there's so few wineries in that area. Most all the wineries tend to congregate down in the south, and there's none of them way up north because of the elevation. Rivers. Told you the Connecticut River runs all along the western border of it. That's where most all the rivers run into the Connecticut River. They drain into Connecticut. The only other one that is a big river running down is the Merrimack River. Cuts right down basically to the center of the state. And there's a big lake, I don't know how to pronounce it. I'm not going to, let's try it. Winnipesaukee, I think it is. There's no, that is a great big lake located north of Concord in that part of the, state. And, that's, you know, the geography of the state. I always like to cover it and let people know, you know, where the state is. The New Hampshire wineries, there are, you know, I'll say, but then we'll ask our guest speakers tonight to tell us exactly how many. I have seen numbers ranging from 22 up to 28 down to 14. The maps that I have and the things that I show are giving us 22 wineries in the state of New Hampshire. Most of them, like I stated earlier, are located in the southern part. There is one up in the northern part that is Crooked Tree Winery. We're not talking to anybody from there, but we will be talking to a couple people from the southern part of the state and the wineries this week, and I think we might have someone next week, beginning of next week, from New Hampshire that we'll continue to talk to. New Hampshire wineries, it is not, actually, 1994, when the industry started back up after a law, there were two wineries in New Hampshire. Jewelltown Vineyards and Flag Hill. And Flag Hill is actually the one we're going to be talking to first, someone from Flag Hill. And each of them produced wines from locally grown grapes. In 97, Candia Vineyards started and started formal planning in 1998. Next week, we'll be talking to Candia wineries, some old wineries that were willing to call us and talk with us. They try to do as much as they can. New Hampshire, let's see, I don't think New Hampshire has an AVA, an American Viticulture Area. I couldn't find anything listed of it, but it might have one now. The records and stuff I find might not be up to date, so they may have a viticulture area. The state of New Hampshire was established in 1788, and the vineyards, the wine industry started in 1974. There's approximately 20 vineyards planted throughout the state, or 20 acres per vineyard on average, five vineyards on what I'm showing here. The grapes produced, number of wineries, this map shows 15. Grapes produced, Aurora, Cuyahoga, Chancellor, Chardonnay, Deschanel, Diamond, Frontenac, Liam Merlot, Marechal Foch, Niagara, cold weather grapes. We've been covering a lot of cold weather states over the last couple, 3 weeks, it seems, over the last month or more, actually. And most of them are cold weather grapes that they grow there. Let's see, New Hampshire Winery Association is located. They got a number of members that are growers of grapes and cider and mead and fruit wine growers and producers and academics within the state of New Hampshire that are interested in the wine industry. They allow all of them in. They have a number of members that are throughout the state. In fact, one of them, Flag Hill, is a member. We'll be talking to them in a minute. We'll find out more about it. They got a few associate members from different walks of life and different things that are associated with the wine industry, but their New Hampshire Winery Association is the association that they do stuff within the state there. Well, I just noticed from Mike here we're having problems getting someone on the line from Flag Hill Winery, so let me just continue talking about the wineries and the grapes in the state then. Let's see, Mike is, I see, here it is. Frank is in the garden. Frank is the owner of Flag Hill Winery, and he is in the garden right now. I don't know if it's the vineyard or if it's a flower garden, but we'll find out. And he's supposed to be coming on. They're supposed to be getting. He'll be coming online. Heather Hole, I believe that's how it's pronounced, is the person who I contacted originally up there. Heather is the head of marketing. I'm sorry, I had a blank there for a second. Heather is the head of marketing for Flag Hill Winery. Flag Hill Winery is located in the southeastern part of the state, east of Concord, and about midway through the ocean and Concord. I don't want to tell you a whole bunch about it because we got someone coming on going to be talking about Flag Hill Winery. So what I think I'm going to do is I'm going to talk to you about a couple other wineries that are in the state before we start talking about Flag Hill. One of them I do want to talk about is Farnham Hill Winery, our ciders, Farnham Hill Ciders. And the reason I want to talk about that is because, maybe I won't here because it's not giving me a connection. A lot of wineries I found are making ciders up there in that area from all sorts of different things, apples and honey and mead and stuff. There's quite a few meaderies, I believe that's the proper word for it, for that part of the state. A lot of honey being done and a lot of mead wineries. Let's see, I think this is the one that I was looking at that does that. Yeah, this is I was expecting to have a speaker on here. I apologize for my unpreparedness on this particular part here. Here we go. Vinter Cellars of Bedford, New Hampshire. Vinter Cellars. Here we go. Vinter Cellars is closed. They have closed down. Well, that was a bad choice of one there, wasn't it? We're going to talk about New Hampshire.
Okay,
eventually.
Are you there? Yes.
Oh,
are
yeah,
there?
I am.
I have Frank on the line with us, and Frank is very busy up there. Frank, you're on with us.
I'm glad to be here. Caught me by surprise, but I'm delighted to be able to talk to you guys.
Hello, Frank. This is Ron. You've already talked to Mike here for a minute here. I understand you're the winemaker for Flag Hill Winery.
Actually, let me make a little correction. No, I am actually the owner and president of the corporation.
My winemaker
has made it home for the evening, and but I was the winemaker for 10 years, if that matters.
Oh, okay. Well, then that's good. Well, I just we want to welcome you to the Blog Talk Radio program All About Wine. I just have questions for you. I'm not going to put you on the spot or anything. Just a few things I want to talk about. We're highlighting New Hampshire, obviously, this week on the program. And tell us about New Hampshire wine. Tell us about Flag Hill Winery. I understand you're one of the oldest ones in the state. Is that correct?
That is correct. We are we are kind of like the first of the new regime. Winemaking in New Hampshire, I think probably most of your customers would be surprised. But winemaking's going on for about 35 years, all unsuccessfully. And back in the early 1990s, I decided to give it one more additional try. And we have 25 acres of may not be familiar with. They're referred to as French hybrid grapes. Our delightful weather in downtown Lee, New Hampshire, where I'm located, is a little cool for the grapes of California or down south. So we have a hybrid grape that's designed to tolerate our temperatures, which go down to about minus 18 degrees in the winter.
Oh, my God.
So they have to be a bit hardy. And as a reference point, a Cabernet, for instance, has a winter tolerance of about plus 8 degrees. So as you can see, they wouldn't like our country up here.
Yeah, and that for one winter, that would be about it.
And that's what we have learned. Of course, we do great with the native varieties, the Vitis Lambruscas, the Concords, and the Delawares, and the Niagaras, and like that. But they're not exactly mainstream wine. So we have grapes with names like Maréchal Foch, Léon Milot, Sauvel Blanc, and Vida Blanc. They are all referred to as French hybrids, with the exception of La Crescent, which is actually a Minnesota hybrid. Who thought Minnesota would grow a lot of grapes, huh? And they, in fact, have done exceptionally well. But these grapes have been growing very nicely in this region. They actually came from the New York region where we bought them. And they are doing exceptionally well, just like all the small vineyards in the United States now. It seems like the renaissance is going on, and people are opening their eyes to saying there isn't just a Cabernet in the world. There actually is, you know, dozens and dozens of red wines, and I think we're all in the wine industry are enjoying that that renaissance, if you will.
Yes. Mm. So what grapes do you have planted on your 20 acres, you said?
Yeah, we have a little over 20 acres, and with grapes, our stalwart red would be Maréchal Foch and Dichonac. Those are the two red grapes. And then we have Sauvel Blanc, Vidal Blanc in the white grapes, and Cayuga, which is an American hybrid actually invented by Cornell University as the other hybrid. Again, I think a lot of your viewers may not be familiar with these, or I guess, are they new to you too?
Well, actually, we've been doing this program, and we've been talking to quite a few northern states. We're in New Hampshire now alphabetically, so we've talked to Maine, we've talked to Minnesota, we've talked to Michigan. So a lot of people in cold weather climates do have those because they are cold hardy. I mean, you know.
Yeah, and they have actually turned out to be quite successful. Be honest with you, we actually started taking some of our hybrids out, and now we're going with the Minnesota varieties because, quite frankly, they are the next step in disease-resistant and have a winter tolerance down to about minus 40. So we see that as the next generation of grapevines to tolerate the weather up here.
Yeah, Minnesota's doing great on coming up with hybrids and stuff. A lot of wineries that we've talked to around in the cold weather areas in the freezing areas seem to really are finding great success with the Minnesota hybrids.
And I couldn't agree with that more. We have done our research, and certainly I think that we're going to see a lot more of it. And it looks to me like with well over 6,000 wineries in the United States, the end is not in sight yet. So quite frankly, we still see more planting. And even in New Hampshire, which we see a lot of our fruit come from New York, to be candid. There isn't that many vineyards, but we do have 27 wineries, and of that, only about 8 are actually growing. The challenge is, I guess, very familiar probably to your area, the darn in southern New Hampshire, where the weather is most suited for it, the land is too expensive for agriculture. You know, it's somewhere around $125,000 an acre for land.
Wow.
It's a little difficult to justify putting in an acre of grapes that will produce about $4,000 worth of grapes. But what is going on in New Hampshire, though, which may be similar to other areas of the United States, is that a lot of the old dairy farms, and I am on a 180-acre dairy farm, and it went out of business like most of the dairy in this region, and looking to either, A, divide it into house lots, which obviously nobody likes to see, or convert it, and vineyards have been an alternate choice for dairy land, and that's what we've done here, is we converted from dairy to grapes. And, of course, as you may know, we are also a distillery, so we've managed to fill all those grapes and still justify the agricultural existence in a very urban area at this point.
Where, the soil. Tell us about your soil in your area and New Hampshire in general, if you will.
Yeah, interestingly enough, my particular property is about 6 miles from the Portsmouth, which is the seacoast region. And if we were here 10,000 years ago, it would be oceanfront property, which means we see a lot of silts and clay, which are unsuitable. However, if it is not silt or clay, it is, quite frankly, sand and gravel with exceptionally good drainage, which actually turns out to be very reasonable for grapes in this region. The soil quality is, the humus is a little thin, but quite frankly, it's average for growing and a good wind drainage in this area. The rest of the country, quite frankly, in this rest of New Hampshire, is more of a stony environment, and quite frankly, finding 5 feet without a 5 foot stone is sometimes tricky. But there is some good land, and it usually is well drained. The problem with us, I would say, it's not soil, and it's not weather; it's frost. If there's any one thing that kicks our butt up here, is that the spring comes early. And a lot of these grapevines want to bud out early, and then invariably with that moon in May or somewhere around the 15th to 20th of May, Mother Nature likes to get even and frost us off.
Mm-hmm.
So frost protection or dealing with frost, if I had to say what was the most miserable thing, that's it right there.
And, really?
Very difficult to deal with.
When do you usually get bud break then?
Bud break will occur right around the first week, sometimes the second week in May. And frost could occur as easy as or as late as the third week in May, depending on the season. We are actually, believe it or not, it's 46 out right now. Yesterday it was 94.
94,
today it's 46. Yeah, we had a heat wave going, and now I'm out. I was actually just came in from the vineyard. My wife says, hey, there's this radio show. And so I was literally had a coat on, and I was saying, Jesus, it's cold up here right now.
From 94
typical New England weather. It's you know the old saying, wait a few minutes, and the weather definitely does change.
Yeah, well, so while we're talking about weather, what give me your summer – well, obviously you get over 90. Your summer highs, your winter lows, and you know your temperature ranges.
Good questions. Well, first off, our summer highs, we enjoy the August humidity like I guess everybody does, and in the dog days of summer are just as unpleasant up here. We will rarely have what is referred to as a heat wave with 3 days over 90 degrees. On occasion, we'll see maybe one throughout the whole season. The rest of the time, it's going to hang to 90 or less.
So you've already had your one day.
Yeah, and we got that one out of the way. Now we're getting ready to go back to winter, I think. But
wow.
The colds definitely do get down tough, and we will see temperatures. Last year, this last season, we got down to temperatures in this region here about -5, which was, quite frankly, a great year for us. And however, the year before, we saw -16. And even with a hybrid at -16, you're going to see some bud damage. And we had seen that, but I got to confess, as a typical farmer with amazing optimism, I will tell you this particular year we've had a perfect season so far, just amount of rain, and we're well past frost damage, and the bud set is looking particularly good. All we need now is just get the sun out and get us through the season. And then for us, we have to look forward to enjoying the darn Japanese beetles. I don't know if you got them down there, but they are our nemesis, to say the least.
No, we have other problems. We don't have to worry about the Japanese beetle. We have Pierce disease that affects us. So.
Oh, Well, I got to tell you, we do not have a Pierce disease problem, and if it wasn't for the Japanese beetle, quite frankly, most of the area up here could go organic because there's no other pests out here that bother us. Obviously, with the humidity, we do have some mildew issues, particularly downy mildew is a typical problem in hybrids, and but not a severe one. It is manageable as long as you have a good vineyard manager.
Do you hand harvest or do you machine harvest?
We pick everything by hand. In fact, we greatest story in the world. If you can imagine a small family farm converted over to a vineyard, it was kind of like an exponential problem. Year one, I had the first acre come in, and I went down there and picked it myself. Year two, we had 3 acres, and I called my brothers and sisters and neighbors and said, hey, give me a hand. And they all said, sure. Well, by about year six, we had about 20 acres out there, and I said, okay, I'll put the hamburgers on. I'll do anything you want. Just please come over and help me. Well, it sort of caught on, and we do a thing called Harvest Fest now. And in general, between our email list and all the social media, we have about 7,000 people. We have to run a lottery now. To select people, and we bring 200 people over every weekend, usually on a Saturday, and we send them down there like locusts, and no offense intended, but they are exceptionally good migrant workers, and they get to play vineyard people for an afternoon. We don't work them for more than about 3 hours. We feed them like crazy and let them drink till they drop, but they turn into dedicated harvesters. And the average person can go down in a couple hours, pick maybe 200 pounds of fruit without busting their hump, and they become the loyalest customers in the world because it's now their wine. To be honest with you, we could have easily gone to machine harvesting at this point, but I see no reason in it. I actually turn around, and during harvest, I make money. Because, A, when they come, they eat, they buy. And then they bring their brothers and sisters and mothers back every 2 weeks to brag about all their efforts. So it has turned out to be a model that I wouldn't disturb and wouldn't put a harvester out there anytime in the near future as long as we keep selling like we are.
That sounds like a great way to do it, too. That's, we found through a lot of the wineries we've talked to, when they bring people in like that, it's always a fantastic results and everything. So that's wonderful. Tell us about your wines. Do you do any fruit wines or do you just do grape wines 100%? What do you age it in? Fill us in on that.
Good. Well, as far as the wines go, we have 9 varieties of grape wines. And as you would expect, we've had a couple of bad years. And during the bad years, we got into the fruit wine and quite frankly held on to it. Typical fruits up here are first off wild lowbush blueberries, which make an exceptionally delightful, almost like a red wine category that has been extremely popular in both in recognitions and with various competitions. And then the other ones you would naturally expect would be apple, because we have more apples than you can shake a stick at. Then you can throw in cranberry, because this is a cranberry area, or cranberry apple, which is the one that goes with that. Those are typically the fruits that you can really get into around here, and they're very reasonably priced. And we make all of those. In fact, I would say at least half of the wineries up here generally will do most of those fruits just because they're so readily available. I think the reason we don't see too much of the rest of it, because, quite frankly, you can't get 3 or 4 tons of raspberries in this region without shipping them in. And most of us are trying to, as certainly we are here, trying to ride the local movement and emphasizing the geographic location where the fruit came from. So for us, and I'm sure it may be in your area, we're really seeing the importance of getting the local fruit.
Right.
And so, as far as that goes, the rest of the fruits and we have here all go into our liqueurs for the distillery side of things. So for every wine, we make a liqueur that matches it. But that represents 18 different wines that we produce here on a regular basis, along with a couple of dessert wines. And for the most part, the only thing we'll age here will be Maréchal Foch. We'll age that for up to 4 years. Foch is a rather acidic, abrasive wine that definitely needs to sit on oak for a couple of years for it to soften up, or leave it for about 10 years any other way. because it just it is a uniquely distinctive wine, and it really has some great characters. But it definitely the acidity in the body, and the body being thin. In fact, if you were to characterize the red wines from New England, let me be careful, not say New England, from let's say Northern New England. I don't want those guys down south to start jumping on me. But our wines, because our soils are extremely acidic, the reason why we have so many pine trees up here is that carries pretty much into the grapes themselves. So we have to manage the vineyard extremely careful and really emphasize on light in the vineyard and ripening. Otherwise, we'll have a wine that'll have so much acidity you just can't deal with it.
Uh-huh.
But even when we successfully deal with it, aging is the only way, I think, to soften up the foch to make it a really drinkable wine. And even after you're done, a lot of people want to come in and they want to have a robust a wine like a heavy Merlot or a Cabernet. And unfortunately, we just can't grow those types of grapes. So it turns more like a Pinot Noir, to be honest, not any not a heavy-bodied wine like we got some people, you know, seem to emphasize that, particularly the jocks of the world. Give me your big, red, heavy wine, you know, with a manly voice on them as if
right,
you know what
right.
it is. But
we all get
if
that.
I was to
yeah.
characterize, actually, the other side of the coin is that New England's forte, I think, or Northern New England's forte, is always going to be on the Germanic-style white wines.
Mm-hmm.
We can do Cayuga, Vignol, Vidal extremely nicely, and the weather is very well-suited for it. And I would tell you that that is where the best products in the wine world we've produced up here. And as part of the Winery Association, we have been emphasizing, you know, try to go where the suit is strong, and that is where it will always be.
What oak are you using?
We're using primarily American oak, and it's actually from Canton. And it's the old saying goes, it's a French barrel makers from American oak made in California. So it's a worldwide product. But most of it comes from the mid, the Ozark region, I believe, is where most
mm-hmm.
of the oak
yeah.
is coming from this.
Arkansas, and, Missouri, yeah.
Yeah, and it seems to be, it's a good oak. It's a reasonable price. We're paying about $325 a barrel, and it's producing, I think, balancing the price of the barrel and the quality of the wine. Oftentimes people said, oh, you're going to get much better results with a French oak barrel, but I'm not sure, you know, the old saying, a silk's purse out of a sow's ear. I'm just not sure there's a relationship there that will justify the change. So we find American oak very appropriate, and it balances it out nicely and keep the price at a reasonable level. So we're going to stick with that model.
You know, just FYI, I've talked to quite a few, like I say, different wineries around the country, and Minnesota oak is really getting rave reviews right now. I don't know if you've checked into it or not. Minnesota and Texas oak are rivaling Missouri and Arkansas oak, the Ozark oak, as for quality and for price. And they're getting a really good taste and all that. So something you might look at.
That's,
you know.
That's actually an interesting tip because, quite frankly, so far everything that I've seen out of Minnesota has been fairly good because we just finished putting in another acre of a Marquette, which is in the Minnesota variety, and we had La Crescent last year. So you can see I'm a real fan of these grapes because I think they've got a real future. So I will certainly be delighted to look into something like that.
Sounds yeah, Minnesota oak. A lot of wineries I've talked to are using Minnesota oak now, and they're just everybody's praising it. So it's you know, something. Does New Hampshire have an AVA?
No, we do not, and it is unlikely that we're going to be able to get one. Unless we went to, there's sort of, you could say, there's a southern area, and there's everywhere else. But I don't think we can actually distinguish it because the other large winery in the state, the next largest to this, is a place called Jewelltown. And we looked at it and sort of did some geographic researching and talked to the University of New Hampshire. Quite frankly, there is nothing distinctive that we could think to create an AVA, even though it would be nice. So our AVA, New Hampshire.
Yeah, yeah. It works.
Yeah, it works.
But your government, New Hampshire government, good, bad, indifferent. You wish they were dead. You wish they go away. What's
well,
Tell me.
I got to be careful because I don't want to cross over here, because being both a winery and a distillery, they are very distinctively. But from a wine side, first off, we enjoy, and I use that word loosely, the fact that this is a state-controlled state, which means we have 92 state liquor stores. And we have a state liquor commission that wants to play by their rules, which does aggravate the situation a little bit. However, I think that, to be fair to them, I think that I got to choose my words here carefully. For the most part, liquor commissions like the state of New Hampshire have pretty much never had to deal with wineries in their history. And so for them, particularly back 20 years ago when I started, quite frankly, if you excuse the expression, I think we were a pain in their ass.
Mm-hmm.
And because we weren't producing anything, and we were asking them to distribute in the state stores, and they said we weren't worth the time or energy or money. And so it created an adversarial relationship. The good news is, as more wineries came in, and I think typically what happens is the wine quality start improving and the winery associations get organized and we start looking at quality, quantity issues, and then all of a sudden the liquor commissions start having a new attitude. And for us, this emergence occurred about 3 years ago. And I think, like a lot of small wineries, I couldn't, in the life of me, get Hannaford Graham, Hannaford Brand, Shaw's, or DeMolis to touch our wines. They just weren't interested. And about 3 years ago, they all of a sudden says, well, we'll give it a try. And quite frankly, it has worked. And now we are riding the bow wave of the locavore movement. And then finally, the Liquor Commission says, no, wait a minute. You guys are selling all this wine. Maybe we want to do this now. So we've had a kind of a renaissance in there. They're interested in our products and are providing our shelf space. They are good people. It's just like most governments, they are lag the problem. And when you've got a bunch of young, anxious winemakers like we do, you know, 27 of them, they're all wanting to do these things and do immediately. And state governments aren't known for moving fast, if you will.
Right.
So I would say, all in all, the laws are slowly changing. Thanks to particularly Wine America, and I am the representative for the state of New Hampshire, and we have had a tremendous amount of help changing the laws to make more sense for the state, and it's not because the state didn't do it, it's because it was never needed before. And so it's everything you want to do is make simple, but first you have to go back and change the law, and as you know, that takes at least a season to get done.
At least.
And somebody has to mother it through, which is a pain in the gazoo. But at this point, so, I would say we're okay.
You are familiar with H.R. 1161 then?
Yes. Yes.
Oh, good. Okay. I always like to point that out to whoever I talk to be sure they are familiar with it. How about shipping? Shipping in, shipping out. What's the rules on that?
Yeah. To be honest with you, it's almost a dead subject here. And that's kind of one of the stories I like to say. I had the greatest look for that. I sent four of my tasting room staff off to California to be trained in, and you know, the whole thing with wine clubs and all that sort of stuff and shipping and all that. And for us, as we sit here right now, the reality is that I can't afford to have licenses in the other states. I don't have time to manage the problem, and quite frankly, we virtually don't do any shipping at all. And for the most part, I would say that pretty much characterizes all of the state of New Hampshire. And it's not that it's restrictive. In fact, the laws are pretty much the same as the rest of the states. We're on par. It's just the administration of it. When you're a small winery, I can't get a compliance person. For instance, even if I wanted to ship to Connecticut, just, you know, 100 miles south, getting the license, tracking it, paying the fees and all of that, it quite frankly is not worth the work. And for the five customers I might get from Connecticut that are going to ask to ship, it just turns into, I think, if you'll excuse the expression, the bad guys won this one. Even though we won the battle, we lost the war.
Yeah, yeah. I know what you mean on that. Mike, you have any questions you can think of?
There was one thing I was going to bring up about the frost you mentioned. Back in March when we were talking to Minnesota, we talked to Carlos Creek Winery, and I believe Tammy said that they last year they lost 75% of their crop due to the late frost that they had, and they took a major hit. And I believe Carlos Creek is the largest in Minnesota, so they definitely were hit by frost, and it's just also when you, because we've had some similar issues with the northern states that are affected by winter, when you get to mentioning your hours of operation and everything, let us know if you're open year-round, because a lot of them are not. The further north we go, the less availability they are, it seems like.
Yeah, and that certainly, I think, is a real common point. But back to the frost issue, we saw the same thing. We lost 25% of our fruit last year because of the early spring and the drop. And that's where fruit wines come in, because our policy here at Flag Hill is that we will only sell grapes that we actually grow here. So the only other choice is to buy a hell of a lot of blueberries and you know, cranberries and apples, which turns out, because unlike, I would tell you, one of the things, even myself, and I'm a UC Davis guy myself, the attitude toward fruit wines is slowly changing too. I can tell you that it's interesting, because a lot of the consumers, let's say even 10 years ago, if you offered them a fruit wine, they literally would not touch it. It is unacceptable. And I think between changes in attitude and changes in the quality of the wine, fruit wines are making great strides in this region, and they quite frankly have improved considerably. And some of them are absolutely delightful. Even the meads we're seeing up here now are really beginning to gain strength. I think a lot of it has to do with time working it. So I wanted to comment on that. And the other is, the frost protection. And we have combated that with mist irrigation, which is currently our defense. And that's the first piece we did. And then we're going to try to couple that with wind as soon as we can afford to put it in. But misting is using the same piping as you do for drip irrigation. You can create a mist irrigation that sprinkles over the top of it that has, I installed last year, interestingly enough, after getting burned for the fifth time, that we think that's going to be a good avenue at a reasonable cost to try to work on frost protection. You got to do something. I don't think you can ignore it, which I think a lot of us have tried to do, because the weather has just been too variable lately all over the United States, as we all know.
Yes. Well, we, being in Florida, we're familiar with frost. We got our oranges and our strawberries and all that other good stuff that everybody in the country always sees coated with ice whenever we get frost down here. So, you know, it's a standard thing. You put that little bit of freeze on it, and it keeps it at a consistent temperature instead of getting it real, real bad. So,
yeah, and we think that's a reasonable, cost-effective way, because it just has worked for us. And your other comment about hours of operation, yeah, it is. Many of the wineries up here, I think once we get to January, when the snow's up to our yin-yang, there's not a lot of motivation nor customers. We are open year-round and have found that once you create a good loyal base, you really can't shut down. We have chosen to stay open, but we are also a restaurant and a catering facility. So I have used that to kind of cut the corners on the quiet times, because it's a good chance to do winemaker's dinners and do some of the things that we don't do in the summers, because we just don't have the time. So I think that is also part of, as I look at all the wineries that are propping up, I found that in New Hampshire it would be unwise to be just a vineyard, or should I say just a winery, only because if you are strapped to the dependence on the grapes you're growing, Mother Nature is just too nasty. And if you don't have another source, as in with, I chose to start a distillery but also run a restaurant, is that there's opportunities with the fruit, the restaurant, and kind of using them all together to parlay it to a more stable income, because quite frankly, over the last 20 years, I've been hit a couple of times very hard in the grape world, and if I didn't have some of the source, I would just be a casualty of the weather up in New England.
Oh, wow.
So,
that's probably
diversity
why
is the answer.
Probably why we have some of the wineries that are closed down then, as I was going through and trying to get a hold of them. Well, to sum up, I want you to give me all the information about Flag Hill, your website, your phone numbers, your location, everything, so
yep.
people who might be up in that area can stop by and say, hey, we heard you on All About Wine. So,
well, delighted to do that, and I am very proud of our website. It's flaghill.com. That's with one G, and it is a great site. It has all of our wine products and pictures of what we sell here and our catering and restaurant facilities. And we are open Wednesdays through Sunday from 11 to 5 year-round. And the secret is come in January and you'll get all of my attention because there's not much else doing other than shoveling snow. Either that or I'm going to be down with you guys where I should be, to be honest with you.
There you go.
Absolutely. Apparently you have an event going on there this evening or
we are,
what I heard.
Yeah, which is sort of, you know, one of the things I wanted to throw out at you is that one of the things that we have found, and particularly when I started this business, I was the winemaker and I did all the appropriate things, and now I just shoot the bull most of the time and run the business. But we have learned, and all of my employees know, that the secret to success is your customers. And realizing that they have to be in your face, on your property, in your cellar, in your barrel room, in your tasting room, in your bathroom, in everything. And if
yes.
you don't like that, you almost shouldn't be in the business. And because it is such a people business in my mind, and you have to really enjoy having them everywhere. And
without
they will
a doubt.
Go everywhere and do everything if you give them the opportunity, including pick your grapes. They'll even prune if you let them. If you just give them a little knowledge and treat them decently. But if you're not that kind of a person and you think you're just a winemaker, chances are you're going to make wine, but only for yourself.
That's true. That's very true.
Yeah.
Well, Frank, thank
so
you
what
very
else
much.
Leave off?
It was a great conversation with you, and I really appreciate it. And best of luck to you. And if we ever get ourselves up into that part of the country, and I almost guarantee you it's not going to be in the winter.
No.
Well, that shows you are a smart man, clearly, because I don't blame you one little bit. But,
so
I do appreciate your interest in us people up here up north, and we thank
absolutely.
You very much up here.
And well, yeah. thank you very much for your time tonight.
You have a great day to both of you.
You too.
Thank you. Thank you.
Yeah, bye-bye.
Bye.
All right. Let me see.
Good.
We'll go ahead and bring on our next guest, right?
Yeah.
We'll go and do that. We put him on air. Here we go. Well, see if that went through. There is a delay here for some reason. See, there you go. Okay, Chuck, are you there?
Yes, I'm here.
Hello, okay, Chuck. This is Ron. We've been communicating via email. Now I finally get to talk with you.
Yeah,
I understand
good,
you
wonderful.
Were listening to the program earlier tonight.
Yes. I've been sort of having this neat technological moment where I've been actually listening to your show on the internet and talking to you on the phone at the same time.
Fantastic. Oh, that's the way to do it. Well, then you know some of the questions I'm going to ask you, because basically it's going to be the same thing. Where are you located? Where is Hermit Wood Winery?
Hermit Wood Winery is in central New Hampshire. It's about an hour drive north of where Frank's Winery is, and we're in what we call the Lakes region. It's sort of the transition between the seacoast and the mountainous region in the Mount Washington area, more famously known for things like on Golden Pond and Lake Winnipesaukee and those sort of tourist areas, summer tourist areas in New Hampshire. And we're on top of Steel Hill, which overlooks Lake Winnesquam. It's in Sandrington.
Oh, wow. Sounds like a beautiful spot. What is your website? You're brand new, aren't you? You guys just opened.
We're beyond brand new. We haven't actually opened our doors yet. We're getting very close. We've been working on this for a couple of years, and I have two other partners in this, Ken Hardcastle and Bob Manley. And it's been this mutual fun avocation that just sort of grew organically into this this wonderful fun business that's just been a tremendous project for us, all three of us. And without all three of us working on this, I don't know how it could have happened, because it's been so much work. But we have the resources and the enthusiasm for this with our different talents and in the process, that it's just coming together really well. We're really excited about opening, which should be the beginning of July for our grand opening.
Wow. Hmm. Well, this is exciting for me too, because we have never talked to someone who is brand new like this. We, you know, most of the ones we've talked to have been a little bit established. I mean, anywhere from 3 or 4 years up to, you know, 15-20 years. But why? Why did you all do this? Give us a little background on what started you getting into the wine business. I mean, you know the old saying, you know how to make a small fortune in the wine business. You start with a large fortune. You know, so.
Right, exactly. Well, fortunately, our fortune isn't so much in investing wealth in the business. It's investing what each of us already brings to the table. So we didn't have to buy a lot of infrastructure and the winemaking gear we've been just gathering over time, because we just went out with our wives. We went to Canada on a wine tour. We've all been to California on wine tours. And one of the Bob was just came back from France and did a wine tour over there. We just, something we've done together, and we really enjoyed it. And we thought, geez, if they have this great wine trail in Quebec, which is, of course, north of New Hampshire, why on earth can't we do that here? And why aren't we doing this? We love it. It's just great fun. So the downside to our business plan is that we're not going to start off with a gargantuan winery. It's something that is within our current means right now. So as Frank alluded to, if we don't draw the crowd in, we'll just have a heck of a lot of wine to drink, and we'll be just as happy either way.
I like that attitude.
Yeah, we're really sort of in a win-win situation. I mean, nobody will lose their shirt if all of a sudden the FDA decides that wine can't be sold in this country tomorrow or something like that. Like, we'll be fine.
Good, good. So what are you looking at making? What are your grapes or your fruits or whatever you're planning on presenting to people?
Yeah, well, interestingly, my family goes back in the New Hampshire area for, 300 years or so, and I've always been fascinated by what is it that grows in New Hampshire that can make an interesting wine or even alcoholic beverage. And the apples came to New Hampshire as a source of winter sustenance through fermenting. And so initially this great apple culture that we had in New Hampshire is sort of rebounding a little bit. And we have quite a few old orchards and family orchards that are still in business in our area. And we really like the idea of supporting local agriculture and sort of bringing back the family farm and the local food production in New Hampshire. So we're really keen on apple wines. And some of the first apple wine that we made actually came from mostly our friends and neighbors all getting together and making cider in the fall. And so we just picked wild, they're not really wild trees, but unkept trees that are, throughout the neighborhoods and out in the woods and everywhere that people could find trees, all for free. And we would just get together with this great assortment of strange apples and make a cider. We started making a cider wine from that, the hard cider and the cider wine, and we really like it. It's a different product. It's not a Budweiser or a typical American sort of beverage. But we realized that once we got used to the idea that this was local, this is what we could make here. It really has grown on us, and we're all big fans of it now. And I think that, with the local movement that Frank had talked about, that there are others like-minded that would also be interested in our products, and that is pretty much borne out with our local friends that have been a part of this process as we've been growing.
So are you looking at, I know it's all conjecture, but you're looking at doing others than fruit wines in the future, or?
There's so much to talk about. so we're doing apple wine. Our real launch apple wine is actually made from a Dolgo crab apple, and it just so happened we picked this Dolgo crab apple. It's a Russian variety, and it was brought to this to New Hampshire, I think, as to complement cider and it's really actually a really beautiful ornamental tree. You can see them all over the place. It has a really nice sort of bigger crab apple, and the bricks last year on these apples got up to about 17 to 19, which is great for an apple. In fact, that's about as high as you can get, except for another variety called Roxbury Russet that will push over 20. So now we're getting apples that are in almost a grape level of sugar that are nice, flavorful winemaking.
If I may interrupt, crab apple getting that high of a bricks, I've always considered crab apple to be a very acidic, high pH apple.
Yeah, so did we. Yeah, that's an excellent point, and that's why it was when our winemaker Ken first decided that he was going to make wine from these crab apples. We just expected it to be really tannic and acidic, and it is actually really tannic and acidic. It met our expectations, but what we didn't realize is that it also really has a lot of sugar in it. So we can balance the wine out and increase the sweetness level to balance off the acidity and the tannins, and it makes a really nice, slightly acidic, really refreshing summer sort of wine that's maybe the equivalent of a lemonade in terms of how it affects your palate. It's on a hot summer afternoon, it's just a really, really refreshing drink, particularly served on ice on your porch.
What sugar levels are you ending up with, and what alcohol levels are you ending up with?
Generally, we're shooting for around 12 to 13% in our wines, plus or minus a bit here and there. That's generally what we're winding up with on much of the fruit wine. We have to add sugar to it to get it up to that, and we'll do that as necessary because we have to have the product be shelf stable, and it has to have enough alcohol content to balance out the rest of the wine. So, but that's generally what we shoot for. For example, the basic just generic apples that we picked from around the region, we're coming up with a hard cider of about 7. So that's where, without having the sweeter apples in there, that's about what we would come out with. And that's a good product to get you through the winter, but it's not really that shelf stable. So
that's your standard cider then, isn't it? Around 7. That's from what I remember.
Yeah,
that's what you're going to run across.
Yeah. That would be cider. Yeah, the distinction between the cider and the wine really is the alcohol content.
Yeah.
So
okay.
The cider would be about 7, and the wine would be above 10 to in the 12. We shoot for 12 ish.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's about what all my wines are, right around 12. The winery itself? What you said that it was basically already there is you bought an existing building.
Well, yeah, our winery, this is a sort of a funny story, but one of our partners and his wife live in this really beautiful, nicely architected house that's up on top of a hill and overlooking the hills of New Hampshire and the lakes, and the part of the house had been an addition, and it was too much house for them to handle just he and his wife. So we came up with this idea that we could get rid of all that darn house and turn half of it into a winery.
Oh. Chuck, may I interrupt you just for a second? I'll let you go on.
Sure.
We're getting toward the end of our standard program here. We got 6 seconds, but that doesn't mean we're going off the air. We're going to continue to talk with Chuck here. But if anyone out there is listening to this live and you want to continue listening to it, then it will be on archives. We're not going to say goodbye to Chuck yet. We are going to stay on the program with him. So be sure to grab it on archives. You all know how to do that and everything.
Yep.
And So I just want to get that in. We're almost out of time on live, but we will still be on the program, and we still will have all this on archives.
Mm-hmm.
So thank you, Chuck. Go on.
Okay, yes, back to the be careful what you wish for story. So anyway, the wish was for less house space. The end result has been that, you know, a third or more of the house has turned into a winery, and most of the basement is now, we have a processing area where it's temperature controlled, and then we have a cold storage for long-term fermenting and settling. And what used to be known as the office and the basement, and the master bedroom has been converted into our wine tasting area. So, we've gained the winery; they've lost half their house. But they only—I mean, what could be worse, or what could be better than to have, you know, 500, 800 cases of awesome wine in your basement at any given time?
That's true. That's true.
There, it's got to be pretty awesome.
I can't think of a better plan myself. Yeah.
That's the story of how we have the infrastructure, and the limiting factor for us is that we're always going to be a small winery. I mean, we only have so much space, and that's just the way it is, and which is fine. We're excited to be doing what we're doing, and we will only be open, for I don't know, most of the summer months, 3 or 4 days a week. That's about all the wine we'll be able to produce.
Well, not to scare you, not to frighten you, but we have talked to many wineries in the last year and a half, 2 years, and a lot of them have said, well, we started out just as a little small winery. We're planning on staying small. Now we're up to this enormous place and all that. So, you know, best laid plans of mice and men, as the saying goes. So.
What a great problem to have, you know.
Yeah.
If we go down that road, and you know, we have so many people at the winery, we can't take it anymore. We have to do something. That would be a dream come true. We'd all absolutely love it. And if that did happen, then I'm sure the opportunities to grow and become a larger organization would be great. We'd love to have that happen, but. It's, at this point, it sort of is what it is, and hopefully, it will go well, and we will feel like doing that, and then those doors will open up as we get to them, I suppose.
And that would be great for your future. What who's working the winery? Who's going to be the? You mentioned that your winemaker is Ken. Who's going to be the bookkeeper, and who's going to be the tasting room manager, and all that? How are you going to divide up these duties?
Excellent question. We have, it's really three couples that have gotten together that have formed this corporation. So it's us three guys and all our wives. And everybody's sort of taken on some role to help with our various processes. The Bob's wife, Geraldine, is really, I named her the princess of the tasting room this weekend, because we've been working on this room now for a month, and we've built a beautiful bar and a beautiful wine rack, and it's just a really beautiful room. I mean, it's a wonderful house to begin with, and the room is really well lighted, and it's just going to be so much fun to be in there doing wine tastings, and she's really excited about that, and she's pretty much going to be the one behind the tasting room. I will certainly be there as time permits, and Bob, her husband, will be there as time permits, and Ken will probably make guest appearances, because there's nothing he likes more than sharing his unique specialty batches of wine. So Bob is into marketing, and he and his brother have come up with this great business card and logo and label design and all this stuff that's really just way beyond anything I could have ever dreamed up. It's really professionally done, and he's working in doing the website, and he's spending quite a bit of time on Facebook right now too. So we're going down the marketing road of the more, you know, the more social network side of things, and Then Ken is our winemaker. He's been fermenting. He's loved to ferment things his entire life. His dad is a PhD chemist. And he's been fermenting as long as he can remember. But he started off as a beer maker, and he's really a fantastic beer maker. And the wine he started about 10 years ago with some kits. And as we got more interested in wine and whatnot, we challenged him. I think Billy Bob challenged him to go down this road of winemaking. And he's one of those scientific-minded people that just grabs onto something and can't let go. And he's really obsessed with it in a great way. I mean, he's making wine out of anything he can get his hands on that grows locally. And then his other favorite thing is mead. So he's a beekeeper, and he's been making mead.
Wow.
I don't know, he just opened up last year his 14-year-old bottle of mead. And I think that was his oldest that he had, and that was the last of that variety. And he was ecstatic with how great it had become over 14 years. So he's been at this for a while. And one of our launch wines that we'll have in the tasting room this summer is, we're calling it, at least for now, we're calling it a three-honey mead. And it's a third of its honey from his backyard. It's all raw, unprocessed honey. And then another third of it comes from southern New Hampshire, same sort of raw format. And then I think the rest of it came from a beekeeper in Maine. And so we made, I think, 500 liters of this three honey mead. And
wow.
It's just straight mead. We didn't add any fruit to it. And I have to say, I don't know if it was the volume that we made it at, but it is just, it's fermented dry, and it is not overly, I don't know how much mead you've had, but mead has this sort of a honey side to it that a lot of people don't like. And this is really, how can I say, it's sort of like light and inobtrusive mead. It really has come out well, and I'm really excited about that. He loves making mead and blending it with anything else, too. And we'll have his other mead that I think is going to take off is called Red Scare, or at least that's what it's called now. I'm not sure that that'll make it through the marketing department. But it's a blend of blackberry and blueberry and whichever was the honey of the season. Sometimes he pulls his hives, honey out of his hives when different trees are blooming. So, for example, in his area, there's a bunch of poplar trees that bloom early, and he'll pull the honey out of that and make a mead that's, you know, distinctly a poplar mead. And you can tell it's a lighter, different flowery flavor than say the Japanese knotweed honey that comes out later, which is also very good. It's just different.
Different taste, yeah. You were talking about the different flavors. I was going to ask you about that. What ones? Because down here, I mean, we obviously the orange blossom mead and stuff like that. We have some meaderies down here, and I do love a mead. A lot of them though tend to get that honey finish that's almost overpowering. That blackberry blueberry one sounds fascinating.
Yeah. The nice thing with the blackberry and blueberry is the other thing he's working on is elderberry. Is that it adds a tannic side to it. And, you know, those berries need the sweet, and the honey needs the tannins. And his berry adding is very oriented towards balancing the wine, or balancing the honey, I really think is how that works. And we've made the other wine and Frank alluded to this as well, that we're really excited about is our blueberry wine. And the blueberries we are using are from the coast of Maine because that's the closest source we have for local lowbush blueberries. The lowbush blueberries are these really tiny berries, and they do grow in our area. It's just that you have to climb to the top of a 3,000-foot mountain. And in as much as I love outdoors and when exercise, I can't carry 1,000 pounds of tiny little berries that would take me a month to take on my backpack. So that's just not going to happen anytime soon. But anyway, the coast of Maine, and this is from the Ellsworth Bar Harbor area, is just, that's all it is. It's this coastal scrub that's full of blueberries, and there's people up there that's their livelihood, and we get the berries are really breathtaking. They're small. They have a lot of skin, just like with making a grape wine. Decent sugar content, and there's about 1 pound of blueberries in every bottle of our blueberry wine that we're making. And this year's blueberry, and I don't, you know, we're not entirely sure if it's an anomaly because of the great growing season last year, but the blueberry wine this year is just. It's unlike any I've ever had, and even at the other wineries, it's more rich bodied, and I want to say it has a blueberry nose and flavors to it. But in the past, the blueberry wines that I've had and the ones that we made have been very light bodied, and this is much more more like a Cabernet sort of body.
Wow.
Of blueberry wine. And, I'm not sure, you know, maybe it's the year, the berries, or just that we, you know, we've changed our ratio in the processing. I'm not entirely sure, but whatever it is, we like it. We hope to be able to keep doing this for indefinitely because it's really a wonderful wine. I'm very excited about that. And then the other fun thing that we did with the blueberry this year, as we were doing some processing, is that. We're working at the winery, and it's 20 below zero outside, and Ken, being the great experimenter, made three different batches with three different yeasts, a little bit different blueberry ratios, just to see what each one would taste like, and these were all done in 5-gallon carboys. And so we decided on a lark just to pour some of these off into a 5-gallon plastic bucket and let them freeze and jack the blueberry. Or like a jack cider to make it more intense.
Right.
And we did that, and we've come up with this iced blueberry that is somewhere between, I can't tell you what Ken calls it, but it is, it's like a port. it's a blueberry port, it's really, say, up there with a Sauterne or an ice wine. I guess really technically it would be an ice wine. And so we really enjoyed that. And, you know, again, that's something that we didn't have to have a big freezer and put a lot of, outside energy into making. Is that we live in a damn cold place in the winter. And we have this opportunity to make this wonderful port-like blueberry drink, and so that's what we should do. It sort of flows with the energy of the land that we live on, and that's sort of complies with our mission as a, you know, group of families working together on a project.
It sounds. I make a strawberry wine or a strawberry port that turns out really well. I use local Plant City strawberries, and it's something that that I've been very proud of for quite some time. So, you know, you find something like that you put a little pride in, and mine jumps off the shelf. People taste it, and it just I just can't seem to keep it on the shelf. So I know what you mean by finding something that you like.
I guess that's the ultimate test, isn't it?
yeah, that's it. You know, as long as people are buying it. I pulled up your website here. Which one is you, which one is Ken, and which one is Bob?
Let's see. I'm the good-looking one.
Oh, that narrows it down.
Let's see. Well, Bob is committed to bringing back the genre of the hat. So Bob
there's Bob then. You know, with mustache and beard.
That's Bob. And Ken is in the middle, and I'm in the foreground.
I see. Okay. So I have the advantage on you. I see what you look like.
I saw your picture.
You know, did you? Don't believe everything you see. All right, that's all I can say.
Okay.
Your website, you guys are going to have to start filling in these coming soon things here.
Oh, boy. Yeah, being this new business thing, and I might have mentioned, or I know I probably didn't mention, that we all actually have jobs, too. So it's definitely a work in progress, and Bob has been our big push right now. And again, we don't have a staff. I mean, we are the everything that gets done. So, I mean, we're the carpenter and the bookkeeper and the website builder and everything else. So, unfortunately, in Ken's case, he lives on, 5 hours of sleep, but I certainly need more than that. And Bob may not need as much as I do, but where the winery tasting room is at his house. The big push right now has been to get the tasting room ready. We've spent a lot of time with the local town leaders getting our property approved to do this, and that's taken a huge amount of effort. And we're still working with the TTB on label approval, and all of this stuff is as I think Frank put it, a huge time suck. And yep. So some things are going to happen when they happen. So the website is getting there. But I do promise you this, it will be innovative and very much fun. We've already got the thing called the Hermit Cam.
Mm-hmm. And, I see that.
But when we do processing, we have a live feed in our processing room, and you can actually log on and watch the process, which I was fortunate enough to do last week. We brought in some grapes from South America, Carmenere and a Cabernet Sauvignon.
From obviously Chile.
Yeah, from Chile, yeah. And you might say, well, how is that local? And it's our silly argument really is that the most local South American grapes we could get.
Wait, what winery are you pulling those out of?
They came out of the we get them from a distributor, and I'm not sure. We didn't go down there and handpick them or anything like that. We've just been making wine from this one particular outfit's grapes for the last 3 years, and we make this because we all really like big red wines.
Oh, yeah.
It's just something we like.
Phenomenal.
I think that just got racked off the gross leaves the other day. But anyway, I'm on the road a lot, and I was, 2,000 miles away, and I got to watch everybody, all the volunteers, do all the fun work of pressing the grapes the day that those came in, on the Hermit Camp. So that's one of the fun things that Bob's already got going for our internet presence, and I'm expect that he'll have more fun sort of things to do. And right now he's spending more time on Facebook, generating, interest in who we are and what we're doing, and getting sort of people that would be interested in wine and like to talk about it, sort of like your show, to get them engaged, because the people that like to talk about it also like to drink wine. So they'll
yes.
come and they'll participate in our wine tasting, and hopefully buy some of our wine.
Go ahead. When we first opened the Florida Estates Winery, which is the winery I have, we got a bunch of wine from Chile. And Venus and Esteban, located in Aconcagua Valley, which is north of Santiago, is where ours came from. And we had a Carmenere, Merlot, Cabernet, Sauvignon Blanc, and a Chardonnay. Carmenere is a phenomenal. I fell in love with the Carmenere. I mean, that's just, without a doubt, it's just a phenomenal grape.
Yes, yeah. I've worked for the last couple of years as a wine rep for an importer of South American wines, and I really love them. I think that they have the terroir there that is unique. I mean, the South American wines taste a bit different from the California wines, and they've got great winemakers there too. So they really have the best of many worlds down there in South America. I'm a big fan. And the Carmenere, we just got, I tasted some of it out of the barrel the other day, and it has got that wonderful tannin and the spicy side of it it's just fantastic.
Carmenere aroma, yes, it is just beautiful. Mike, you had something to ask?
Just one thing. I was interested in how you got the name Hermit Woods. Is it a particular, you know, where you're located, or is it something that y'all came up with?
Yeah, it's inspired. I think we live off of Hermit Woods Road, and there was actually a hermit who lived on this road, and his estate is still there. A guy named Joseph Plummer, and in the late 1700s, he basically holed up out in the middle of nowhere off this road and lived as a pretty much a recluse. And so the whole area became known as the Hermit Woods, and there's a Hermit Pond and the Hermit Road. And so we're up on Steel Hill, and there's a Steel Hill Resort, which initially we thought that would be a good name because, you know, there's a resort, and people at the resort would want to be connected to a winery, which who wouldn't want to be connected to a winery, and they didn't like the idea at all, which was fine. And so we scratched our heads and our wives, and we all sat around, we brainstormed, we came up with 100 different names from Native American names, and then somebody somewhere along the side, well, why not Hermit Woods? We're in Hermit Woods. Like, it was one of those aha moments where the answer was just sitting there in front of you, and it was too obvious to see. And so it turns out that I think his story is going to be published on our website. This guy was very unique. He made cider, he thought, say, differently from everybody else. I mean, he lived off the beaten path. He lived his life to his own understanding of the way things should be, and that's sort of how we're approaching the business. In other words, we're sensitive to the needs of the customer, but our guiding light is trying to do the right thing that in our belief system of what the right thing is, and we want to make wine that sort of follows suit with that. So it's been sort of inspiring. And you know, we were out working on the yard and doing some of the landscaping for our opening, and when we were trying to make a decision on you know, how much detail we would put into whatever process we were doing, we keep coming back to asking, well, what would the hermit do in this situation? And it's sort of helpful in some sort of strange way, you know, to help us get things done. So yeah, that's the hermit. There's a really fun story about it. I think Bob's got that on the website. If he doesn't, it will be before too long.
Fantastic. Well, give us all the information about Hermit Woods Winery, when you're going to be opening, your address, your phone number, your website, everything, so any listeners out there can, when they're up in that part of the country, stop by and visit you and taste some of your great apple and mead wines.
Wonderful. I appreciate the opportunity to plug the business. We are at 56 Taylor Road. That's in Sanborntown, Sanborntown, New Hampshire. Our phone number is area code 603-253-7968. Our website is www.hermitwoods.com. You can follow us on Facebook at Hermit Woods. And that's pretty much how to get a hold of us. Do check our website and do call before coming. Right now, we're in process of opening. We will be open certainly weekends. We're not sure if it's going to be Thursday, Friday, Saturday, Sunday, or Friday, Saturday, Sunday. And it will be a 1 to 5 range or 1 to 6 or something like that. So the hours I recommend calling or checking the website for updates on the times that we're open. And it's always possible to call ahead and we'll just open. That's fine too. We're very small, very casual.
You will probably open throughout the winter too, since it is a home where Bob is living. So
Yes. Yes, we will definitely be there, and that, I would say that that would be by appointment, because we'll have to shovel the driveway so you can get up there. Like, it's snow. And maybe we'll send the dog team down to bring people up. But yes, that's an excellent point, and we would certainly be happy to entertain people during the winter as well.
Wow.
The other plug that I'll say is that up the street, a quarter of a mile from our winery, is a resort that has a captive audience that turns about 300 people a weekend. And my fear with this is that, you know, with our 500 cases of wine that we'll have for sale this year, aren't going to last very long.
That's a good fear to have.
And particularly, you know, I think that the blueberry wine is going to fly off the shelves. And then the last thing I'll say is that, you know, our primary sales point of sales will be at the winery, I'm sure. But we also have, Ken is a sort of an experimenter, and he's been trying to gain years and years and years of fermenting experience in a very short period of time by running, I think he made 60 different varieties of wine in the last year and a half.
Wow.
He's trying everything, and in our tasting room, those crazy varieties of, you know, pepper spiced mead or knotweed wine or knotweed blackberry wine or tomato wine, which actually is quite good, will also be available on a very small scale. So we have a lot of fun stuff going on there. Again, I'm afraid that it's not going to fly off the shelves. So.
That's a good problem to have. Hermit Woods, it's great to get to be able to talk to you on a new startup like this. This is rather exciting, something new for All About Wine, to be able to talk to a winery that just that hasn't really opened their doors yet to the public. So
we really
appreciate your information and your candidness about what's going on and what you've been doing and all that. And we wish the absolute best of luck to you and what you guys are doing. And
there was I'm sorry to interrupt there, but there was something I was asking, because you mentioned when you went to Canada and you experienced some wine trails up there.
Mm.
And are there any wine trails in New Hampshire? And if not, are you kind of gearing towards that also, maybe in the future, of creating some sort of a wine trail in that area?
Yes. There is already, and has been for a while. And the Lakes region has just gotten on that wine trail. In other words, there's been one for the southern tier, Frank's Winery at Flag Hill. And then we have several other wineries opening in our area. And as the wineries get open, the trail map will be extended. But, yes, there is one. And We're a member of the New Hampshire Winery Association, and the New Hampshire Winery Association.com has links to all of the wineries and the trail map as well.
Oh, good. Okay.
They're a good resource.
Yeah, I remember you mentioned that, and I forgot to say that earlier. So, okay, great.
There's so much to talk about, and you know, I think it is an interesting perspective that we haven't opened, and you know, we're full of vim and vigor and enthusiasm. It would be fun to talk again in a year and see how all of this came out at the end of the first year, and whether our hopes and dreams and predictions and sales have been good or not.
Yeah, absolutely.
We will put you on our calendar. We will talk to you 1 year from now.
Great. Sounds perfect.
Excellent.
Ron and Mike, thank you very much for having this program. I think it's wonderful. I've enjoyed listening to it, and I will be downloading. I'm actually in Nebraska right now, and I saw that you talked to the people from Nebraska last week.
Yes.
So I'm looking forward to listening to those conversations as well. So thank you guys
very
much.
Well, thank you very much, Chuck. And again, best of luck to you guys.
Mm-hmm. All right. Thank you. All right.
There you go.
Thanks. We'll be in touch. Right. Bye-bye.
Thank you. Wow, very interesting.
Good program tonight.
Yeah, I like that. We ran a little over, but you know, that's a part of it, and we can do that. So to heck with it.
Yeah, really. I mean, people can listen to it on archives. They didn't miss. If they didn't listen to archives, then they have plenty of information when we talked to Frank earlier. So
yeah, but, very interesting.
It was fun talking to Chuck there and finding out all the information, everything that he had to give us. And like I say, it's great to talk to a startup winery. We've never had that opportunity. And so it was
also on their website. I was not able to sign up for the newsletter from the main homepage, but if you go to the contact page, there's another blank space there, and that link, that button did work. So I did sign up for their newsletter, and hopefully I'll start getting something there. They also have a blog for Hermit Woods Winery. There's also a blog where they've been updating quite a bit. So very interesting, and best of luck, and hope it works out for them. You know, it sounds like a neat operation. So
we'll call them in a year, and we'll see what's going on with them.
Yeah, they'll probably be sitting out there sold out of everything.
Yeah, really. Yeah.
The way he was talking down the road, you know.
Down the road. He's got a resort down the road from him. Yeah. Oh, winery. And there it goes.
That was it. So definitely thank you, Chuck. And we'll definitely have to talk. We'll check back, a little later on and see how he's doing after they open. So that'll be interesting. And Frank as well, Frank with Flag Hill Winery, thank you again. And it took a little bit to get him on the phone, but boy, they ran out there and got him. I mean, they're having an event tonight, and I guess that's where Heather was. They also had us down for 1 p.m., so I didn't understand that. But anyway, you are on Eastern, but I don't know what happened there, what country that was. But there must have been a something deal, you know, wrong with the time zone. But she was out, I guess. They said Heather was out working an event, and Frank was out in the garden. And but they were able to run out there and get him because Heather was busy. So definitely busy, and I'm sure Frank was too. But he said, "Oh yeah, we're ready to talk." So so that was cool, and glad we got him in.
Next week we're going to
continue
a little bit of New Hampshire. We've got Bob Dabrowski, I believe is pronounced, from Candia Vineyards. And we're going to get him on the air and talk a little bit more about New Hampshire wineries. I'll tell you, if Bob's half as informative as with Chuck and Frank tonight, then it's going to continue being a great program next week. So
yes, it can carry on as long as we need to. So that's fine.
That's great.
So definitely tune in to us next week. We'll be on live again on Thursday, and that date will be the ninth. So definitely check back again on right here on blogtalkradio.com/ all about wine, and you'll see what our episode is, which will be a continuation of New Hampshire. And as always, Ron, it was a very, very good show, and I don't think we've ever gone past 8:15, 8:10 somewhere around here, but this was good.
We had a lot of information. It was very interesting.
Yeah, very good. Thank you again to Frank and Chuck up in New Hampshire for talking with us, even though it's in the 40s, I guess. Up there.
Well, actually now, Chuck's not there. He said he was in Nebraska.
Chuck is in Nebraska. We should have, what's it like where he's at? But
he was in Nebraska. He heard, but, you know, like Frank said, it was about 94 yesterday. Now today it was 46. Unbelievable.
Yeah. And I'm coming in, it's like 90 something degrees, and he says, "Oh, I had my coat on. I was outside." Really?
Yeah, okay. Really. So
way it is. So we'll see how it is next week with Bob, the other winery up there that I forgot what the name was. I just
Candia.
Wrote Bob DeBrus.
Candia is actually a very big winery, one of the older ones in the state. So that should be interesting also.
Yep, so tune in next Thursday, and we'll be on again at 7 p.m. Eastern Time right here on Blog Talk Radio. Thank you, everybody, for listening to us. If you're listening to us now, you're listening to us on archives, and we love archive listeners. I believe that's where we get the bulk of the people downloading, listening to us on iTunes as a free download. Thank you all for listening to the archives, and we'll see you all next Thursday. Thank you, Ron.
Next Thursday, yeah. Thank
we'll
you, Mike.
Thank you, and we'll see everybody then. Have a good night. Have a good week.
Okay. Yeah, really.
All right. We're
in the green room?